Hi, everybody. Welcome to Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle. I'm Bobby Osinski, and this is a show all about music, music production, and the music business. My guest today is the great mixing engineer, Dave Pensado. We'll discuss something that you might not know about him, which is that he, at one time, was a smoking hot guitar player way before he became the smoking hot engineer that he is today. But first, let's talk about Tidal, a new streaming service. It's called Tidal, T-I-D-A-L. And what sets it apart from everything else is the fact that it streams in CD quality. That's right, 44.1 kilohertz, 16-bit. And it will also stream to your mobile device, your mobile phone, which makes it different from everything else. The only other service right now that streams in high quality is Deezer. And you need the Deezer Elite tier for that to work. And what that means is it only works if you have hardware from either Bose or from Sonos. So that leaves Tidal with being just about the only service right now that does a legitimate high-res stream to your mobile device or to your computer. Now, the downside of Tidal is the fact that it's $19.95 a month. Most other services are $9.95 a month. Tidal is $19.95. So the average person will probably not be into this because, hey, you can get it for free. Why should you pay $19.95? But I have to say, after listening to it for a number of days, it really sounds great. And it's so much fun to listen to music that sounds really good again that it makes listening enjoyable in a way that it's hard to describe because it just doesn't happen that way with MP3s. The new Tidal service is actually significant in a couple of ways. The first is the fact that, yes, they're the first in coming out with this, but the second thing is it's going to influence all the other streaming services. The thing to remember is that Apple has been collecting high-res masters for a couple of years now with their Master for iTunes program. As a result, they have a wealth of material at not just CD quality, but 9624. So that's going to be a big deal when they finally come out with their new service, which is what Beats Music is going to turn into. And it looks like it's going to be an offshoot of iTunes, and it will be some sort of iTunes streaming. We don't know what it is yet. We don't know when it's going to hit. I speculate that it'll be somewhere in January or February, but we'll see. You might think, okay, there's one other service, and that's Pono. And that's Neil Young's service. And of course, they're going to be doing high-res downloads, which is significantly different. First of all, the downloads are expensive. And also, it takes time to actually download something, which a lot of people don't want to do anymore. So this is a service that probably is only going to be for audiophiles. I don't think it'll ever catch on with the mass audience. The other mistake I think they really made is there's no headphones with it. You would think that an expensive piece of hardware like that, which is $300 or $400, it would come with a really good set of headphones so you could hear the difference between what they were playing and the other services very easily. But that's not the case, so I think that's going to hurt them as well. Nevertheless, the fact that Tidal is now here with high-res streaming is definitely going to influence everybody else in the market, and I think you're going to see sooner or later all the other services become high-res streaming services, and probably for a lot less than $19.95. The next thing I want to talk about is how not to soundproof your studio. Now, you heard me right, how not to soundproof your studio. There's a lot of people that think that if they put up a certain material on their walls, then they'll automatically get some magic soundproofing out of it, and it doesn't work that way. Unfortunately, brute force is the only way that works. And what do I mean by brute force? Well, the only thing that really works is mass and lots of it, and then you have to seal everything good and tight. You have to think of air is like water. So basically, if you fill up your room with water, where is it going to seep out? Well, exactly the same thing will happen with sound. Anywhere that it could seep out, that water might seep out, that's where your sound is going to seep out, and outside sound is going to seep in as well. So these are the two things that you can do to actually up your isolation, while most people think that, in fact, they can do some other things. So here are some of the materials that people might try to use in order to increase their isolation, and none of them work. The first one is mattresses. First of all, it's expensive to put mattresses on your walls. Second of all, there's a real problem with the fact that they're large, so they'll take up a lot of room, which is also what we don't want. And worst of all, they don't work. They might change the acoustics a little bit, but probably not for the better. So just forget about that one. Another one that you see are egg crates. This is more from, 50s, 60s, 70s that you saw this rather than now. But egg crates don't work. They're hard to get, at least hard to get enough of them. And wow, they're a fire hazard as well. So stay away from egg crates. Carpet. You can put carpet on the wall, and you see that in many rehearsal studios, for instance, and it changes the sound, changes the acoustics. It doesn't help your isolation. It might help it by accident. By accident meaning it, the way you put it up might actually seal some holes that you have so the air doesn't get out or in. But other than that, they're kind of useless. The next thing would be foam rubber. Foam rubber doesn't work. Don't even try it again. A bad fire hazard. Also rubber. Open cell rubber or some closed cell rubber, doesn't matter. Neither one works. Forget about that one too. How about wall cellulose? Some people think that if they fill up their walls with wall cellulose, automatically they're going to get much better isolation. Well, it might improve a little, but a very little. And sometimes it might actually hurt. The reason why, one of the best things that you have that's kind of natural when it comes to isolation is an airspace. And airspaces are used all the time in big studios for isolation. So you have a big wall, an airspace, another big wall. And that's kind of a standard for building studios. If you get rid of that airspace, then you get rid of a lot of the isolation help that the airspace is actually giving you. How about fiberglass insulation? Just normal, everyday B-flat fiberglass insulation, R19, R23, whatever. Well, that doesn't work either, sorry to say, and it takes up a lot of room, and it also will make you itchy, and it also could be a health hazard, so don't use that either. Plywood panels, some people use. Well, plywood panels are too thin to help anything, and if anything, they rattle. So you're just giving yourself some more noises in the studio, and that doesn't make any sense, so stay away from that. One that sort of works is particle board. Particle board is very, very thick and it's very heavy and it can work. But once again, you have the fire hazard because, again, it's condensed sawdust, really, and it will go up in flames. So you have to be careful with that. It's really heavy. It's expensive. It's not worth it. If you live in the Midwest, if you live on a farm, bales of hay actually work, believe it or not. They're a very good isolation device. One of the big problems, of course, is that they're large and also extremely hazardous when it comes to fire. So stay away from bales of hay. And last but not least is everybody's favorite acoustic foam. Now, acoustic foam, many people think is a magic bullet. You put that stuff up in your studio and automatically you're going to increase your isolation. What it does do, it affects the acoustics, but it doesn't change the isolation at all. And it only affects the acoustics in the room for the high frequency. It doesn't do anything for the low frequencies below 1,000 hertz or so. And some of it is a fire hazard as well. So you have to be very careful how you use it, but also don't expect too much. This list came from the Studio Builder's Handbook that I wrote with my friend Dennis Moody. And you can find a lot more acoustic tricks in that book if you're interested. If you have any questions or comments, send them to questions at bobbyoinnercircle.com, questions at bobbyoinnercircle.com. My guest today is the great mixing engineer and my old friend, Dave Pensado. He's mixed so many multi-million sellers and number one hits for Pink and Christina Aguilera, Beyonce, Black Eyed Peas, Justin Timberlake, and many, many more. He's also the host of the popular web show, Pensado's Place. He has a new book out with his manager and co-host, Herb Terwick. So you might want to check that out. I spoke to Dave from his studio lair via Skype, where we talked about his time before he was an engineer when he was a hot guitar player. So Dave, welcome to my podcast. I really enjoy having you on. I'm glad we finally get a chance to do this.
Oh, absolutely, Bobby. You know, for the people in the audience, they might not know that you and I have been friends for a long time, always good to talk to you. I always learn something. And
well, likewise.
I'm kind of sad because you haven't bailed me out in quite a while. And your audience might not know this, but back when 5.1 was popular, I had zero skills at 5.1. And what skills I had, I didn't enjoy. And Bobby would always come in and save my ass, make everything sound great. We had one that we did together that Panasonic actually used as a way to show off their units in Europe. So we did good. But yeah, what's new in your world, Bobby?
Well, thank you. You're too kind. I want to talk about you, Dave Pensado, as a guitar player, because not a lot of people know that before you became the magic mixing engineer that you are today, you were quite the guitar player in your time. So let's go back to then, you know, before you get into engineering and your gig was being a guitar player.
Yeah, you know, my mom taught guitar, was very accomplished. My grandfather played guitar. I always felt that it was the perfect instrument, Bobby. I always felt like everybody that sits down to play a piano pretty much sounds alike. Everybody that sits down and picks up a guitar without changing anything is going to sound different. It's a great, great instrument for expression. If you think about it, guitar and sax are probably two of the instruments that are hardest to replicate with a synthesizer, because they have hundreds and hundreds of nuances that you can express on the guitar with your right hand by palming it, not palming it, the way Billy Gibbons does, where he hits little false harmonics. And then sax has got various degrees of growl and overtones and all that kind of stuff. So I'm sure there's other instruments that are hard, but it's impossible. You always know a fake guitar when you hear it as a synthesizer. So it's a great, great instrument because you can get around on it within a week. Your calluses will hurt a little bit, but I'm a product of all those records that I spent so long trying to figure out what they were playing. And then another advantage to being a guitar player is when you learn piano, you learn the note. When you learn guitar, you learn the tone. So guitar players, we spend an obsessive, inordinate amount of time learning the tone. It's not just, you don't just want to copy Steve Vai's licks, you want to copy his tone. Because without the tone you have, you're not copying your hero. So I think that training at a young age probably had some influence on my ability to focus on one instrument within a mix, you know?
Well, that being said, I've heard recordings of you playing, and you were great. You were a great player. So what rig did you use? Tell us about when you were gigging.
Well, my favorite was PAFs through a late 60s, you know, classic Plexi Marshall. Through through my dear friend Larry Turner, I learned about the 30-watt Celestians, what we all call the greenbacks, that were part of the Marshall Major cabinet. So I had a 100-watt head through the Marshall Major cabinet. I probably was a bit of a purist back then. Maybe I might use a wah-wah pedal, but the Marshall was so perfect. With a PAS, I had a Black Les Paul Custom, and I would use a wah-wah, which I still have that head and that guitar and that cabinet and all my pedals. I was so poor for most of my life. Well, I mean, poor is a different condition. I was so broke all my life. I had to pawn and sell everything, but I managed all these years to hang on to those. I used to like to do kind of like what Clapton and Hendrix did, where you just park the wah-wah pedal on a tone. So if you were in a part of the song that you wanted to really cut through, you'd just leave the wah-wah, you'd set the wah-wah pedal with your foot, but you wouldn't wah-wah it, you just use it to change tone. So if you were playing high notes, you went back on the wah-wah to get a more bass tone, and then as you went to bass strings, you went down to get a little more crisp tone. So I was pretty much a purist back then. Now I'm like anything but the kitchen sink. I listen to guys like Tim Pierce, John Willis, some of the greats, Jerry McPherson, and I could easily be happy with 100 guitar pedal board. To expand this, though, hopefully it's interesting to the audience and not too much about me. But back in the late 80s, early 90s, it seemed like there was an austerity program in terms of effects. We didn't use many, and now I like mixing a little better because we've got the ability to use every color in the book, you know.
Yeah.
There was times in the 90s when I was working with Ice Cube and Coolio and guys like that, where I'd have to hide my effects, because if they saw something blinking, they go, "What's that? What's that?" Oh, that's you know, that's just some. Is that a reverb? Oh, I would never use reverb. But we had hit records anyway, you know. Yeah, guitar. My guitar rig was pretty basic. I wanted to learn how to put my own Floyd Rose in my guitar, and then also want to learn how to do my own frets. I wanted to learn how to do all my own technical work on guitars, because, like I said, I had no money, so I had to do it myself. So I was living in Atlanta. I found the worst period of CBS Strat money can buy, and I bought it for about $20. It was in pieces. Some poor kid had gotten it to take guitar lessons with. He graduated from college and probably never came back to Atlanta, and his mother found it in pieces and sold it to me. And like a true guitar player, I said, "This is worth a lot more. Will your son be angry?" And she said, "Oh, he doesn't care. Just give me the money." So that guitar, I still have two. I learned how to refinish guitars. I refinished it four times before I got it right. I routed the nut correctly, two tries on the Floyd Rose. I did that. I did fret jobs, about 10 fret jobs in a month. I finally got good at that. And I'd always, Larry and I always had club owners coming up to us and telling us to turn it down, because a Marshall only sounds good wide open.
Yeah.
And so I built up the first version of that guitar. I built with no knobs, so I couldn't turn it down. And you'd think that a club owner would just say, "Hey, turn it down at the amp," but I guess they didn't really understand how it worked. And I eventually put knobs on that one, and the MXR made a little white micro amp, and I liked the way that kind of drove the pickups on that Strat a little more. Now, I had humbuckers in the back position of that Strat. I had a PAF, and then the two front positions were stock. And I tapped the coil myself on a humbucker, and so I could get the out-of-phase Strat. It's technically not an out-of-phase, but get that in-between really cool sound.
Yeah.
It's that, if you're new to guitar, go to Lynyrd Skynyrd. The song's called "I Know a Little." That's where you take, you can buy a five position switch, which now is standard. Back in the day, you had to just barely squeak it in to where the bridge pickup and the middle pickup were on. So anyway, I get excited when I talk about guitar. Please edit this down to where it's a
Well, blend. Did you gig a lot?
Yeah, well, that's how I earned a living. Yeah, a lot. Yeah.
So does that mean
that I get paid a lot? That's a different question.
Well, we all started in the same place, you know, when it comes to that. But does that mean that you played in local clubs? You played in, you toured. What does that mean exactly?
Yeah, did a little touring. Toured with a few of the Motown acts. Had a band with. Couple of guys in Skynyrd after the plane crash. I had one, like, you learn to make ends meet, so I went to an apartment complex. I had a real nice clubhouse, and I traded us playing once a month there for two three-bedroom apartments for my band, and we rehearsed there. So, you do what you got to do.
Yeah. Well, how did that lead to you getting into engineering then?
Well, I always was the guy that kind of messed with a PA. My dad was very, very gifted in electronics and chemistry. And it seemed like I was always the guy in the band that owned the PA. And then over time, my PAs got bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. And you know, I don't know if you remember, but I was so proud when I moved. I went from a Shure Vocalmaster, which anybody my age and your age will remember. They were truly horrible, but they were portable, so you could take yourself, a singer, and a drum machine, and go gig. You know,
yeah.
And they were tall columns, and you really couldn't do much. And finally, I got a separate power amp. I think it was a Oh gosh, I can't remember. It was a BSRB.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, and then I had a Crown DC 300, and I was so proud. I had like a 6-channel Tapco board, you know.
Yeah.
The knobs were like the size of silver dollars.
Hey, I was in exactly the same place. Only my first amplifiers were Dynacos.
Oh wow!
Yeah, which actually sounded really good.
Yeah, you know what I'm looking to buy? There's a company called Dynacord that makes a couple of pieces again. I'm not going to show because the price will double, but yeah. There's a couple of pieces of Dynacords that I want to get. They made some really cool stuff.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, so just like me, same thing. You know, you were gifted in electronics and fooling around with it and always in charge of the PA and everything. How did you get into the studio then? Because sound reinforcement is a different animal than recording studio. And you're in one headset mindset with the, in sound reinforcement. And it's a different hat that you have to wear. It's definitely a different way of thinking.
Yeah, I don't know that I was in sound reinforcement. I was in screwing with the sound till it sounded right. great question. I'm blessed that a couple of people cared about some of the paths that I took to get here. So you and I can discuss a little more of that later. But basically, there was a store in Atlanta called Atlanta Discount. George and Chick and the other guys, they would take in used gear, and the first thing they would do is I would drive by once a week. I'd pick it up. I'd repair it. I'm real good with electronics. When I first started engineering, I made all my own gear, or most of it. And then when I got to a real studio, of course, I realized I wasn't that good. I used to repair that, and then I'd bring it back the next trip, and then they would sell it. And their warranties, of course, I did that. So I had a really good grasp of electronics, and just trial and error, growing up from about age 9 or 10. I did this thing, Bobby. I'm going to embarrass myself. So, in the basement of my house, I wanted to put a band together when I was about 8 or 9, but I couldn't find musicians that would play with me because the good ones were too old, and the people my age, they really weren't into it. So what I did was, with my dear sweet mom's help, she sewed two sheets together, and I strung the sheets lengthwise across the basement, and I put spotlights against the wall. So I'm standing with my band members between the sheet and spotlights behind us.
Yeah.
The little kids in the neighborhood would get in front of the sheet, so all they would see was shadows. And then we didn't have real drums, but we had things that looked like drums as a shadow, you know. And I had a guitar, I had two guitars, and so one, we pretended like one was a bass, one was a guitar. And then we had fake microphones. I guess I was about nine, maybe eight. And we would play records, and we would shadow sync the records. We didn't lip sync them; we shadow synced them. And man, after a while, I was charging for that, you know.
Wow!
And my dear sweet mother would later bring Kool-Aid down and little snacks and all, and we'd get audiences sometimes as big as maybe 12 people, 10 or 12 people.
Yeah,
I guess that's where you kind of get the bug to perform, and I'm sure if people are familiar with the show, I do. There's a little bit of that still in me, you know. When Herb and I do the show, I like that spotlight. But I like performing, but I sincerely miss playing live every hour of every day. I miss it. I miss the instant gratification.
Yeah.
I even miss the instant getting hit in the head with a beer bottle, because you learn a lot when a beer bottle hits your head. You really, really, really learn a lot on what not to do next time. And so a lot of times the circuit that I used to play was mostly drunks trying to get drunker and get laid. And I got to entertain them in such a way that they buy more booze, which makes my job harder. So the club owner makes enough money to pay me to come back next day or next week.
Yeah.
And what a great training ground for being a mixer, because you learn really, really fast that subtlety is not your friend. You learn that if you're going to play a million notes for a guitar solo, get ready to duck or get ready to have body armor. And you learn that one note with a lot of feedback and looking like you got to take a bowel movement, roll around on the stage, gets you a standing ovation and preserves your life for another day. And I'm not exaggerating. That's kind of the way I mix. I try to put a little finesse and a little bit of things in the mixes so that I'm satisfied and happy. And then I put a couple of things in there to show off to my exorcist clients that I'm still better than they are. And then, of course, the whole goal of mixing is to increase the income of the person that's paying you, the artist, the label, the producer. So I take my economic responsibilities very seriously. I take my artistic responsibilities very seriously. And I take my respect for our craft very seriously. So that's mixing in a nutshell.
Yeah, but okay, so you were repairing gear for the studio in Atlanta. And then we're going to how you got into the studio yourself then. So how did that happen?
Well, I was transitioning from that, and the fact that experience kind of allowed me to understand how some of these mixers work in the live sound world. And then when my bands weren't playing, I get hired to do live sound a lot of times. A lot of times I use my gear. And Larry and I were talking. There was one day, and we were like, "Man, what should we do?" "Well, I know. Let's build a studio." that was a complete unmitigated disaster on multiple levels. But we met Paul Davis and Phil Benton and Ed C. And through that experience and multiple layers of things in between, it ultimately led to Larry and I working at that studio pretty much with no experience in a studio. And right away, I don't know why, Bobby, I didn't know anything, but maybe I did, because right away we were working, we were making records, we made some of the best records in town. And I think the beauty of the way we kind of came in the back door with no skills is that it was so fresh, so new. Everything was like bigger than life. I mean, just sitting down with a parametric equalizer was the greatest week of my life. You know, it was like the options of things you can do every day was a new discovery. And I think that naivety, I think that's what when it was an asset to getting some skills, because we were so broke. A lot of days it was a choice between gas money to get to the studio and food. We always chose making it to the studio. And we didn't know that we had hard times because it was so much fun. Everything was so new. And we had a hope that would allow us to stay in music. You know, life on the road is probably more fun than the law should allow on multiple levels. But as I was crossing 30, Larry also, it seemed clear that maybe our artist career wasn't going to produce the results we wanted. So we were looking at the studio because we were going to build one, and then having the opportunity to work in one. It's called Monarch Sound. We didn't realize we were struggling. I don't even know if we ever got paid, really. It was just, we were there, we were in a studio. We made records on ourselves, made records on our friends. We made records on anybody that stands still long enough for us to put a mic in front of them. And we got good without really knowing we were even getting good. We learned skills without even knowing, because it was just so much fun. It was like you struggle your entire life to kind of find a lane that can provide you contentment and fulfillment and happiness. And you get a little education. You think that's going to provide that. And then one day you find yourself in a studio, and like everything you've learned in your life, everything you've done now made sense. And now you had a format and a place where all that stuff could have value to people, and your taste and all your idiosyncrasies. And the more idiosyncrasies you had, the more people liked you. I mean, it was like one of the greatest years of my life, you know, except for my family experiences. It was, and I still feel like 90% of that every day when I walk into a studio and work, which I do every day. It just feels like all those days, all those years, all those months where you didn't make any money.
Yeah. I hear you. It makes it all worth it. We've had very parallel career paths, I think, in a way, because, much of the same experiences you had, I had as well.
Without knowing it, I'd been on kind of a quest to find something that captured my entire interests. I had major interests in geology. I had huge rock collections my whole life. I love geology. I love chemistry. I love physics. There's so many things I like. I love fishing. I like dirt bikes. But they didn't feel 100% fulfilling as a career. Music was something that I learned early, and it was like the girl next door that you took for granted, and one day you look at her and you go, wow, this girl's really pretty, and music was like that for me. I had kind of really disrespected it in terms of thinking of it as a way to spend my life. And then when I took it seriously, good things happened. So I guess the moral of that story is not necessarily to get into music, but find that which brings you fulfillment, and then the money will chase you down and all this, the other stuff.
You have a new book out now, and I haven't read it yet. I'd like to, but it's more about your life than it is about engineering, right?
Let me say it reversed. I didn't want to have a book just about my life, and Herb and I talked about it. It's the umbrella focus, the overview is kind of how Herb and I got from where we were to having a successful show. And then you can't do that without getting into some technical things. So I've got a chapter in the book where I break down things that my guests have said on a technical level and kind of show you how I've applied those things into my skill set quite frankly, literally just took what they said and started using those techniques. Although that's not the focus of the book, we've got a multi-book deal with, I can't say a multi-book deal, but we're planning on Hal Leonard, our publisher, is going to give us the opportunity to do more books. And so we wanted this one to kind of be a lot of Herb's philosophies, a lot of Herb's wisdom, whatever the equivalent for me is on that level. But all with the focus of showing you several different pathways from where you are now to where you want to be and how to get there. I'm not the best at knowing when I've done something good or bad, which is a wonderful way to be. But people around me tell me they like it a lot, Bobby. So,
well, I can't wait to read it.
I can't wait for you to read it. Because
when is it available?
It's on Amazon now. And just came out last week. You can get it on Amazon. And if anybody knows where to buy a book, you do, Bobby. what are you up to now, about 3,000 books?
25.
Yeah, like I said. But I hope you like it because I respect your writing so much. I've read probably... seriously read probably 10 of them and then maybe loosely read another 5, but correct me if I'm wrong, I think the first time my name appeared in print was in one of your books, right?
I think it was the original Mixing Engineer's Handbook.
Yeah.
And Eddie Schreier, our mutual dear friend, suggested I talk to you. I was writing it. I said, you know, I need some really good mixers. I know a bunch. I need a bunch more. And he says, well, you have to talk to Dave. And you were riding high at the time, as I think you just got into town, as I recall.
Yeah, I wasn't very good. I had good taste, but Eddie is just a dear, dear, sweet mentor and person that says that I'll always have a fondness for. I used to go by his facility, which was called Future Disc, and I would always direct my clients to use him as a mastering engineer because I'd read about him before I moved to LA and knew he was the best of the best. But Eddie did this thing for me where if somebody brought a mix in that he thought was really special, he'd call me and say, hey, you got to come hear this. This is blowing your doors off. And I'd get over there and he'd play my mix and he'd play that other mix. And everything he played me, I thought was better than me. And he said, I see where you're good here, but maybe you can work on the, like, you know, 10K to 12K area. You're beating his low end, but your low end has a little bit of mud down around 300. And then if I changed studios, which I didn't like to do, he would call me and say, hey, you're hearing too much 800 where you are now. Just, you know, park that in the back of your head because you're 800 shy because you're hearing too much. And, man, he did that for me for years and years and years. And I really think that accelerated my learning curve. I don't know that it's really hard to get good as an engineer without seeing or being exposed to what the top guys do. And I learned in a minor small market. Atlanta had very few engineers at the time, and the ones that were there really helped me a lot, like, you know, Ed C.
Ed was just on the podcast about a month ago.
Yeah, I read it. It was great, wasn't it? And then there was Rodney Mills, there was Tom Kidd, TK we call him, he owns Silent Sound now, and then Tom Wright, Phil Benton, Mike Clark. So, oh my God, so many great engineers. But they had full-time jobs, and you know, they spent what time they could with me. But until I saw how guys did it out here, it wasn't the skill set of the people in Atlanta that was limiting. It was the amount of equipment and the type of equipment. So when I first moved out here, I didn't even know you could put something on the stereo bus. I just had dinner with Ed C last week, and he said, well, the reason, Dave, is we didn't do that. We just didn't do it in Atlanta. So my first exposure out here was Craig Burbage, and then immediately after that, Eddie, and Eddie has some medical problems he's sorting through right now. My heart and prayers are with him. He helped me so much, Bobby.
Yeah, yeah. Well,
you
likewise.
Were first to write about me.
There's a lot of people that want to know what your current setup is. What is your current signal path, and any outboard gear, hardware gear, or it's totally in the box? What do you use?
I use everything. So right now I'm in transition. I had a spot at Eddie's place, and I'm now moving to another place. I don't want to say too much more than that because I'm not superstitious, but sometimes you can jinx things. Maybe we can do an update when I get moved in. But the new facility I'm moving into, it has everything. I've got more outboard gear than just about anybody. While all my friends were buying cars and jewelry and stuff, I bought gear. And I learned this thing from Dylan Dresdo where you can go on eBay, buy a studio, buy all the gear in a studio, pick four pieces that you really want, sell the rest, and you basically got those four pieces free. So I've been doing that for like 30 years. Well, there wasn't eBay back in the day. Back in the day, it was print media, but I got a lot of gear. And that been back when I was buying gear, I could get API 550s for $50 a piece, you know?
Wow.
$50 a piece. And I'm a big proponent that there's not one right way to do anything, from cooking to writing poetry to painting to music. I think the end result is what's important, and how that affects people and you know, the energy, the emotion, the feeling, the engineering, even the technical part, because I'm good at it. I find it a little boring sometimes. And sometimes, I think you were around me one day. I don't know where we were at. Maybe it was Conway. And I just decided for some stupid reason to do a mix with no black gear. I'd just gotten tired of using black gear. So, and so I did a mix with black gear, and it turned out great, number one record. And then another time, I think it was a Coolio record that went top 10. I back in the day, we were arguing about Neves versus SSLs, and so I did a mix where I did the verses on a Neve and the choruses on an SSL. Nobody could tell the difference. So when the digital analog thing came about, digital was at a severe disadvantage. It just didn't sound good. I mean, it wasn't an argument. It just didn't sound good. It had some things that it did well, but not enough to where you could become a, you know, add that to the deck of cards that you wanted to use or to your tool arsenal. But today, there's so many things that digital does good. There's so many things that analog does good. The one thing about digital, in the analog world, you trust your sonic decisions to the gear. Analog gear makes a lot of decisions for you on a sonic level. Now, I like that sometimes, and when I like that, I use it. Now, in the digital world, you have to make the decisions yourself. It's a cold, hard application of your skill set, and if you bring the same techniques to the digital world that you used in the analog world, you will suck. I know, because I made some records that I pray to this day nobody ever hears. But we're at a point now in the discussion where it's really kind of boring and unnecessary. The war is over. By the way, the loudness wars have never started and they'll never be over. We were talking about Future Disc, Eddie Schreier's place. The way they got to be popular was they made louder vinyl than anybody else. That's a loudness war. When we recorded on tape from the very beginning, it was see who could get it the loudest on and off the tape, because that reduced your noise level. Movie trailers, they had to pass an industry-wide rule because the trailers were getting louder than the movies themselves. If you bought a TV when they first came out, the first thing you noticed was how loud the commercials were, because that's a loudness war. And so the FCC had to come in. And anyway, I digress. Next question before I get my underwear in a bunch.
All right, last question here, because I know you're busy. What's the best piece of business advice that you've ever received from anybody or you learned yourself?
Well, I guess the best thing, Bobby, for me is that no matter how many hits you have, no matter how much success you have, it's still a service industry for us. It's not anything other than basically client services. I'm no different than a barber. You come to me, you ask me for a haircut. I provide you with the best service I can. I give you the best haircut I can. I send you out the door and you look like a million bucks, and you come back and you're happy. And I attend a trade show in New York once in a while and learn all the new hip haircuts. I come back and we try to hip your look up a little bit. It's a service industry. And when you treat people right and when you take the time to learn what they want and not just immediately inflict what you want on their creation, always remember, as a mix engineer, you're a guest in their creation. So you want to finish their creation. You don't want to hijack it. And unless they ask you to, and you and I get asked to do that from time to time. So I guess the best piece of information I can impart is that try to create an environment and try to select your gear. Try to select, if you're working at home, don't let your bedroom look like a bedroom. Make it look like you know what you're doing. Look like an engineer. Take your bedroom and have it so that it's convertible from looking like you know what you're doing and you're providing a service for your friends, and you'll do well. And the other advice I'm going to give people is if you read a book or watched a YouTube video on how to drive a car around a NASCAR track at 220 miles an hour, when you finish that 30-minute video, you wouldn't get in a NASCAR and go around a track 220 miles an hour. You might make it a quarter of the way around, but the first turn, you're dead. Guys like you and I, and some of the great, great, great information that's on the web, yeah, we can shorten the time that it would take you to go 200 miles an hour, but we can't eliminate it.
Yeah, yeah.
So I guess those two things, it's a service industry, and have realistic expectations about how you're going to grow and get skills. Be honest with yourself about your skills. If you're not making any money, that's what you're worth. If you're making $20 a song, that's what you're worth. If you're making $4,000 a song, that's what you're worth. Your pay is going to always lag behind your skill set. You can't social media your way to the top.
all of those traditional modern day shortcuts. The only thing that works is doing it, starting out on a go-kart, then move from a go-kart to a little midget car, they call them. By the way, you move up to a NASCAR. And it's the same way. Everybody can just work a day gig for like 6 months, save half your money, get yourself a really good computer, and then get yourself all the VAWs now are pretty good. Just grab one, get started, record your friends, get an expensive mic, record yourself, and you'll wait on Bobby Ozinski's show.
Or your show, for that matter. Anyway, Dave, thanks so much for being on the podcast today. I really appreciate it. And we'll have to have you back again to talk for the next book, whenever the next book comes out. The best way to find out everything you need to know about Dave is to go to pensadosplace.tv. It's Pensados Place, PensadosPlace. And when you go there, you'll be able to watch his shows, which are some of the best, most entertaining audio discussions that you'll ever hear. Thanks for listening and being in my inner circle. Remember, if you have any questions or comments, send them to questions@bobbyoinnercircle.com, questions@bobbyoinnercircle.com. Many thanks to Steve Cherubino, who's the host of the Producer Podcast at theproducer.club. He helps put the show together. Thank you, Steve. To listen to other episodes of Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle, go to bobbyosinski.com and select the podcast tab, or you can go right to bobbyoinnercircle.com, or you can find it on iTunes or Stitcher. At bobbyosinski.com, you'll also find a sign-up form for my newsletter and for alerts for new podcasts. This is Bobby Osinski. I'll see you next time.